Well, let's waste no time. This guy, always loved getting his perspective. No one brings more perspective. No one brings more abs and luscious locks than the lefty from Logan. Number 13, Riley Nelson. Riley, how you doing, my friend?
Thanks for the wonderful intro, as always, Dusty. Glad to be on.
You know, I stay up late at night, and I try to think of more superlatives to add to when I bring you in on interviews, Riley. So I appreciate you recognizing that.
Yeah, the alliteration is a nice touch. Logan, lefty, luscious lock. You know, a lot of L's in there. Maybe a little bit of an homage to the greatest athlete poet of all time, Muhammad Ali, right, with his recent passing. Maybe we should all try and be a little bit more alliterative.
That is a very good one. I will try to do that on every join now, Riley. You've actually you pointed that out in my mind. Let me ask you the poll question, Riley. Outside of quarterbacks, which BYU position group has a higher ceiling? Running backs, wide receivers, linebackers, or defensive line? And if you think there's another position group that would surprise me, which one do you think would be?
Yeah, you know, I think running backs are an obvious one. I can see why that leads just with Jamal being cleared to play and being back in the program. And then you got Squally Canada, who's, you know, showing some good things. And then, of course, you got Alex Brown, who's been, you know, a stalwart, stable guy. And then, you know, wide receivers are kind of down there at the bottom. I'm excited about, you know, you got Moroni, who was playing really well last year, and albeit limited time, and maybe not against, you know, the tip-top competition, but in the spots he was called on to perform, he performed. And you've got the Jurgensen brothers back. Of course, Kurtz is there. I'm surprised that you'd have that low. It's hard for me, you know, and then you got linebackers. Anytime you got, you know, you got Longy, who's back with 1 year more experience, 1 year wiser, bigger, faster, stronger. If I were to vote on that, I'd probably say highest ceiling, probably linebackers to show out, just because I love Harvey's passion for the game. I love his leadership. I love his approach. I talked to him at the end of spring ball. I love his approach going into the season, into the summer. I'd probably put them first. The biggest question mark for me out of those four probably be D-line. I think Bronson was by far the biggest playmaker, and we are really, I think, going to have to wait to see who that next playmaker will be and who emerges.
No, I agree with you, because I think it's really interesting. I think the defensive backfield actually has the opportunity to be really, really good as well, and I think that could be probably, to my opinion, would be, if I say, surprise position group. I think people will be surprised at how well the DBs play, but I agree with you. I think linebackers, in my opinion, I think the ceiling is bigger, mainly because Francis Bernard switching from running back to linebacker, I think he'll prove to be a better linebacker. I mean, obviously, that's why the move was made, but I think that certainly pushes that ceiling up. What do you think of that?
Yeah, no, I think Francis Bernard would be a great, and you know, I know they kind of moved him around a little bit in spring. If they do any 3-4, the other tough thing about defense, I mean, both defense and offense are seeing quite a bit of schematic change. But with defense having the personnel for 3-4, like, for example, Francis Bernard, I think, would be a great Will linebacker. Like, he reminds me of, oh, my goodness, Colby. Who hurt Sam Bradford's collarbone?
Colby Clawson. Colby
Clawson. Thank you, my goodness. Sorry, Colby, out there. But, you know, that big physical boundary rush linebacker. I think Francis fits perfect there, and I'm not sure how well he fits in a 3-4 scheme where he's got to, you know, maybe cover a little bit more ground, you know, move quickly as powerfully laterally. And you mentioned the defensive backfield. That's another thing. You know, we kind of knew in Coach Medehall's defense that the boundary corner was going to play a lot of boundary flat and be somewhat of a run support, and then, you know, that the safety, both the safety that kind of worked in tandem to support the corner, and the only guy that was ever going to be put out on an island was that field corner, and that was only in certain formation, only against certain formations. So it's interesting, like, really, this year is impossibly difficult to predict because of all the different changes and all the different unknowns.
Riley Nelson joining us here on the Morning Drive. Riley, what is it like? Take us inside the locker room. Take us inside even the quarterback's mind. Every single season for BYU, and especially since 2004, but if you go back and watch some older games on BYU's TV app, you see that every year has this really interesting every year has an expectation level that's very, very high. But since 2004, I feel like that's even ramped up even higher. What's it like for a quarterback at BYU to come into a new season? Because are fan expectations higher than yours? Do quarterbacks and players have more a realistic expectation for the year? Or do you feel like maybe that gets changed a little bit because the fan base is always so optimistic coming into a new season?
I mean, obviously the team's optimistic as well. Like, you got who was winless or maybe with one win last year. I can't think of any, terrible programs. But we'll use, for example, perhaps like University of New Mexico or like University of Idaho, some of our former Mount West folks. All those dudes are setting up the season with the same goals. Conference championship, we want to get into a New Year's Six Bowl, like all that kind of stuff. I know that's not as much as in the BCS, with the change in college playoff now, but like everyone wants to win their conference and get to the highest bowl possible. Obviously, with BYU not having a conference, but it's the same there would be in the conference. You want to win every game and get to the biggest bowl possible. So everyone starts off with that expectation. Now, the difference is players and coaches are in the day-to-day grind, so they break down that overall goal into much smaller goals, so it kind of reduces the emotional impact of that long-term goal. The thing about fans is all we can do is sit out here on the outside looking in and wait and hope and wish and want, and then that causes our emotional, the emotional impact of it to be so much greater, which can also at times cause, the come down to be harder for the fans. We used 2009, for example, beat Oklahoma in the first game. We're start off 4-5-0, and Florida State comes to town, and we're feeling good. Even though Vegas had us as like a touchdown underdog, and of course we got whooped by 35 points. Right? That was I remember the air being completely let out of that stadium. But for us as players, granted it was disappointing and it was a hard loss. But there was nothing we could do but to pick ourselves up by our bootstraps and start preparing for the opponent next week. We don't want to lose any more than the fans want us to lose, but it's just there's the workmanlike component that kind of limits the amount of emotion that you can let affect yourself.
Can you kind of take fans into – I know a lot of fans were frustrated with some of the Broncos. They felt like maybe held you guys back by – maybe downplaying so many different things and only focusing on us. We're not going to focus on our opponent and his belief of what was going to help a team be really successful in those years. And I know a lot of fans are hoping and thinking that maybe Kalani Sitake's approach is different, but was that really that way of fans perceiving Bronco to be that way? Was that accurate within the team, within the team room and what trying to maybe bottle up or maybe, I don't know, real change your expectation level or way he handled the expectations on that 09 team or other teams?
I think what Coach Menahal's approach was always doing was just he didn't want to mitigate. Like, for example, you amp up, you amp up Utah Week or you amp up TCU or whatever it is, and you get some young linebacker running down on kickoff on special teams that's so, geeked out, got the adrenaline pumping, and he throws a punch, and now you get a 15-yard penalty, and now you've lost the field position battle for that quarter and da da da. Like, that was the reason why Coach Menahal always tried to temper emotions and expectations going into big games. I honestly didn't feel like there was any lack of, if there was any lack from Coach Menahal, which I didn't feel or observe as a player, we made up for it as players and the leadership among the player group. The head coach ultimately is the overall leader, but there's a lot of different levels of leadership coming down from you've got your upperclassmen and captains of the overall team. Then you kind of have your leaders or playmakers within each year. And then you go down to your position groups. And those guys, I can tell you, we put in more time in the film room for the likes of, for my year, for example, Utah, Notre Dame, Oregon State, who came in ranked eighth that year. We put in more time on those games than we did some of the other ones, like, we played Idaho or we played New Mexico State. So, that component existed, even though Coach Menahal downplayed it to to the media. So I'm not sure if there's much different that Kalani can do other than that outward facing, kind of speak to the newspapers and media.
Riley Nelson joining us here on the Morning Drive, talking BYU football. Riley, when Bronco always talked about, we're going to focus on us and not focus on our opponent. How much did you see that within the offense? Because I know Robert and I is quoted as saying, there's no such thing as a bad play call. Is there a difference in focusing on you, not focusing on scheme, or was that just more kind of what you were just saying there? We're going to share this. That's what we're saying in the media. That's what we're saying there. But as far as inside the quarterback room and everything else, was that different? And do you think that's going to change with Ty Detmer and crew on offense?
Well, I'll tell you, I got to admit, you quoted Coach Anai, and I'd never heard him quoted that before. It kind of got me distracted, so I didn't hear the rest of the question, but let me address that for a second. having been a play caller, albeit at a high school level, after I got done, I went up to Logan and Coach Smart. I did learn, and I this is a player, and you respect your coaches, and you try your best, because ultimately your job as a player is to execute, right? The coach is just to call plays. But, okay, I'll let him get away with saying there's no such thing as a bad play call, but I will definitely make it a point to point out that there are better play calls. It is true that no matter what the play is, if you execute correctly, it can be a positive play, but there are better play calls to take advantage of trends and fronts and to take advantage of what the defense is trying to do against you than others. So I disagree a little bit there. And then going on, you said, is that going to be different with Coach Detmer? I think that remains to be seen. Here's the other thing is you're asking me some tough questions that I think have a longer timeline. I think at the beginning of the season, the tough thing is we have to jump right away against tough opponents at neutral site on the road, right? But, man, I don't know. It's going to take Ty at least, I think, at the quickest 3-4 games, if not the first half of the season, to really kind of figure out what his identity as a play caller is, and then, go from that to continue getting better. It's just hard to say what Coach Detmer will be like. I mean, I think we can all hope that he's going to be a guy who throws in a wrinkle here or there that can take advantage of, take advantage of something that the defense is doing, as opposed to continually running the base. The base system, but that remains to be seen.
I'll ask you a question that doesn't have near as much time to breathe, okay? what's it like, when you made the move from independent, you got to see the whole change. What's it like in these independent schedules as a team where your schedule is so front-loaded? And you had some schedules that were the infancy of it, maybe had one or two games. When I think back to that 2011 year, right? What's it like when you're getting ready? Because like you're saying, to figure out who Ty Detmer is going to be, it almost is that immediacy. I think that's why I think it's on the forefront of my mind. When you're opening with three of the best Pac-12 South teams that there are to start your season, essentially starting with you're playing the Pac-12 schedule at the beginning of the year. What's that like when you're starting to look at your season and so front-loaded? Is that exciting? Does it kind of give you the thing of like, oh, man, could we start any tougher? How's that? What was that like, that transition and moving from that Mountain West Conference to a front-loaded independent schedule?
So I think it's great because they're really just the logo. And I've been telling everybody this, as everyone's kind of been a little nervous about this schedule. We've got a lot of great logos and the fact that they're good programs that are perennially good, but they're losing a lot of players, and a lot of them are facing a lot of question marks. Take UCLA as a perfect example. I think they lost 6 or 7 dudes to the draft. They lost their defensive leader at Miles Jack. Yeah, they got the good young quarterback coming up, but they were decimated on their offensive line. So it's like, okay, you got UCLA standing there that's perennially good, but we're not really sure how good they are. So, it depends on what you focus on. You can either look at it and be like, oh man, we're not sure what kind of team we are going to be in those first three or four weeks. But guess what? Neither does Arizona, Utah, or UCLA. Those guys don't know what kind of team they're going to be, how good they are. So in a lot of ways, it evens the playing field, whereas you're playing them week 8 or 9 and the team is 7 or 8 and 1 and, has their identity and some mojo and confidence rolling, you actually almost maybe prefer, if you feel if you have a tendency to feel like you're the underdog, you almost prefer to catch them early because it doesn't give a team a chance to get to a rhythm and develop an identity.
I'm going to get you out on this question because we're seeing the changes immediately with more immediately with Kalani. We're not going to do the firesides the night before the game. They're actually going out and doing them now. And I think these fan fests, obviously, BYU's fan fest stuff is always highly successful, always big crowds. What was your thought with the night before firesides and things like that? Do you like some of these changes, maybe getting it out of the way here during the summer and so that when you're in the middle of the year not having to worry about it? Do you like some of this stuff?
I do. I like the fan fest. I think it's important. I think ultimately, you know, any kind of goodwill. I mean, fan, listen, if you struggle, which, again, I mean, I'm optimistic for the season. I think it can be, you know, a 9 or 10 win season just as easily as we could be 500, which the majority of the people are predicting. But I honestly, you know, I'm hoping for 9 or 10 wins. But if that doesn't happen, the more goodwill we can build up, hopefully here in the summer, by doing these fan fests and doing these firesides, the better. Because hopefully, you know, people keep coming to the games and supporting the program, and you know, the fans on Twitter are more kind. So I think that's good. Now, as far as the firesides directly, I kind of treated that on a case-to-case basis. Depending on the week, how you know, energetic I was feeling, you know, how well I felt all our position groups were prepared, I would attend the firesides. I think they were great, and I think all those that didn't attend it, I honestly, there were some life change to do those firesides. But was it mandatory that we had them the Friday night before games? I don't think so. I think as long as you get the word out and the marketing does their job, I think you're going to have just the same impact here in the summer, if not even greater, because, you know, you have it beforehand, and then those people who were perhaps touched by something a certain player said or that they met at the fireside, they got to shake their hand. Now you've got a fan for the whole season. So I think they both have their pros and cons, and I think it's just a different way of doing the same thing, but I'm all for building up BYU's brand and continuing to try and go out and build a great football program, and at the same time, maybe touch or change or influence a life for the better.
I completely agree with you. Well, Riley, we're up against it. Why don't you go ahead and let BYU fans know what you're up to and what's going on in the life of Riley Nelson.
Yeah, I appreciate that. So probably the most relevant thing, since I'm on here to talk about football, some of you may have seen there was an article in Desert News a little bit while ago and or seen on social media. So for any aspiring quarterbacks out there, John Beck, who started a company down with Tom House in Southern California. It's called Edge QB. Go to Edge QB Training on Twitter or edgeqbtraining.com. But he has asked me to partner up with him to train kids here in Utah. So literally to provide world-class training. It's a program that John's been down there training pros mostly. He's got about 25, 30 pros, both starters and backups, that come to him rather consistently. He's taken that program and boiled it down to the essential fundamentals and a different approach to the way of quarterback mechanics and throwing. Anyway, we're doing that here in Utah. So anybody out there, you know, sixth grade and up, that's kind of looking for a little bit of quarterback training, go ahead and find us on Twitter. Again, that's Edge QB Football or Edge QB Training. And direct message us, and we'll get you some of the best information out there for quarterbacks around. I tell you what, I found it the year after I graduated. That's kind of when John teamed up with these guys, and I took my little brother down there to be trained. I wish I would have had that. Boy, when I was in high school, it would have been awesome, or even, you know, just for a year or two when I was in college. The kind of information they're putting out there is revolutionary.
Absolutely, and they couldn't get a guy to teach someone X's and O's better than Riley Nelson. Most people might not know this. This Riley was, he said he was offensive coordinator after graduated at BYU at Logan. He was offensive coordinator in 2005 season as well. Mike Favero may have put it together, but Riley was calling everything. So
I appreciate that. Hey, speaking of Coach Favero, a little shout out to him. I know that I know 960 only played, you know, in the southern part of the valley, but he announced his retirement recently, and we had a nice party for him. One of the great coaches, I'll say the greatest offensive football mind in the state of Utah high school football. So he retired. He had an impressive record. I'm just going to gloat for him a little bit. He was 150 and 47. five state championships, nine region championships, you know, multiple all-state players, multiple players that went on to play D1 football. And so congratulations to him on a great career.
Absolutely. Well, Riley, thank you, my friend. Best of luck with the QB edge training. Get that rolling, man, and then we'll catch up with you soon.
Thanks, Dusty.